This is The Cable.
How much retail ownership is in stock?
Tech story is front and center.
What will this wind up doing to the cost curve?
Your connection from the London market close to the US market action.
A significant sell-off in European assets.
But it feels like a lot of these stocks have already priced that in.
This is a stock that is increasingly being shorted.
The Cable with Guy Johnson and Alex Steele.
Behavioral challenges from the pandemic could linger for years.
On Bloomberg Radio.
Good evening. Welcome. Monday the 28th. You are listening to The Cable. We are live on DAB Digital Radio. I'm Guy Johnson in London alongside Alex Steele, who has returned from her epic shopping of Black Friday, of whatever we call the weekend, and I'm sure Cyber Monday as well. Nice to have you back, Alex.
Thank you. And to the point, I did do all the shopping on Friday online. I did not live stream it because that would be boring. But I also did catch some of the football game with the US and UK. I would come all prepared to talk about it, and then Guy doesn't want to talk about it.
Well, basically because you won.
We totally won. Sorry.
It's hard to deny. It was a draw, but you guys definitely won. Relative to expectations, you guys definitely did a job on us. We didn't look like we were there. Didn't look like we wanted to play. Didn't look like we were interested in playing. Anyway,
or thought that you were too good, that the U.S.
Well, I think there may have been some of that. I think there was a little bit of arrogance in the performance from England. Anyway, we got two big games tomorrow. We'll find out who finishes top of the group, and then we'll have another go at this conversation.
Great. Then I got to watch that too. Fine. Okay. Well, I did get...
Absolutely.
I do have it in my house now, so I can do that.
Excellent. So let's talk about the markets, because we need to kind of focus on what's been happening here. The Black Friday story, in all seriousness, actually is something you want to focus on. It does seem to signal that the US consumer is in fairly good health, though maybe a little bit more tactical or... maybe strategic, actually, in the way you think about the shopping story, i.e. people have been going out and buying stuff they need rather than they want. I think that probably is a narrative. Steel, an exact example of that, buying a Dyson. Excellent.
And sheets. Like, I bought sheets and a vacuum cleaner. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, this is not, like, crazy buying
This is not
stuff.
Shoes.
Yeah, exactly.
That's the most important point here. Were any shoes bought?
Yes, but as a present for my mother.
All right, okay.
So that's different?
That's different and doesn't count.
Waited for the good sale to pull that trigger. So I feel like I am indicative of what the consumer is doing, though, to be honest, in terms of being strategic, buying things you need at a discount, but that you're not, like, desperate to need, and that the stuff you want, depends. Just depends on the price.
But Christmas is covered, so that's important.
Yes.
The other thing that we need to reference, obviously, is what's been happening with China, a more serious story. And one that has certainly had profound market effects today. The protests we've seen over the weekend certainly sending ripples through global markets. The dollar's been reasonably well bid today. The pound's been down quite sharply. Equity markets have been under pressure. The FTSE actually probably outperforming a little bit, basically because the pound has been down so much. But you've also seen some of the healthcare stocks doing well. People have been piling back into the safety of the healthcare sector. But oil, Alex, also down quite a lot.
Yep, and you could definitely make it a China story. You could also make it a let's sell some winners story throughout the year. Oil was already under pressure before the China protests. But to your point, seeing the video of those protests, unbelievable, honestly. Like, that is not stuff that you see in China for decades. It was really tremendous.
We'll come back. We'll talk more about that in just a moment, figure out what the market impact really should be here and how you price all of this risk. Before we do that, though, here is Charlie Pellett with the headlines.
Thank you very much, Guy Johnson. Here's what's going on. UK homebuyers are starting to get discounts on properties in the latest sign of turbulence in the country's housing market. Agreed prices fell below asking prices last month for the first time in 18 months. According to a report from property portal Zoopla, the average discount has increased to 2.4% in the week ending November 19th, the most since January of 2021. Meta Platforms has been slapped with a €265 million, about £228 million fine for failing to prevent the leak of the personal data of more than half a billion users of its Facebook service. This from the Irish Data Protection Commission, the main privacy watchdog for Meta in the European Union. Crypto fraud has jumped by nearly a third in the UK as scammers increasingly target more inexperienced investors. According to data from Action Fraud, the UK's National Reporting Centre for Fraud and cybercrime, the value of UK cryptocurrency fraud leapt 32% to £226 million from £171 million in the year ending September 30th, 2022. And in America, BlockFi has filed for bankruptcy, the latest crypto firm to collapse in the wake of crypto exchange FTX's rapid downfall. Barclays analysts say a total of £29 billion will be wagered on the 2022 FIFA World Cup. That is a 65% increase on the previous edition after a surge in online gambling during the pandemic. And that is the latest from the news desk. Guy Johnson, back to you now in London.
Charlie Pellett, thank you very much indeed. So let's think about the situation that's evolving in China. Significant protests over the weekend. Are we going to see a big crackdown by the Chinese authorities? How would markets react to that? Are we going to see potentially COVID zero being lifted, but then getting significant case counts in China again? How do you price that in? We don't know yet what is going to happen and what is going to evolve. And therefore, how do you think about, from a market pricing point of view, what comes next for the world's second biggest economy? Well, to try and answer that question, Bloomberg's Simon White, macro strategist, joins me now in the studio. Simon, how are you thinking about this?
Oh, hi, Guy. Thanks for having me. So I think there's two things here. There is what it means for the rest of the world, global risk sentiment, and what it means for China. So I think progressively it means less and less for global markets. A lot of this perpetual kind of like rolling lockdowns has been, you know, more and more priced into global markets. Yep. And I looked at, if you look at, for instance, correlation between S&P and Chinese equities, that was very positive in the pandemic. It's now effectively zero. You know, yields today were actually a little bit higher. But when it comes to China, you know, I think it's still a big issue, but really there's much bigger underlying issues that I think are more important. And when COVID zero is gone, they will still be there, and they're the ones that need to be addressed.
And you're talking about the property issues?
Property issues is one, and that relates to the debt issues. So you have China has basically saw the fastest rise in debt versus GDP over the last 12 years in any country. And when you get rapid rises in debt, it tends to often mean a lot of that debt was probably lent in not particularly good conditions, not for good projects, and therefore might ultimately not be viable. And now China's debt service ratio is above 20%, and that's normally a bit of a red line for, you know, more emerging market countries. So, you know, China faces a risk of a debt deflation, and COVID zero isn't helping the situation, but when this situation gets resolved, that problem will still be there, and that's really what China has to try and solve.
And we need the government in place to be able to do that. We were talking to a professor earlier on from King's College who made the point that actually be careful what you wish for. If you do see anything disorderly, a breakdown of sort of the rules in China, if the government struggles to get a grip on the situation, there is no alternative in China. A significant breakdown in law and order, a significant breakdown of government in China, that would be a problem that isn't priced. So I'm wondering what the tail risks look like, how we should be thinking about the tail risks here. If it was to get, I appreciate that in the current scenario, there are other bigger risks to think about, but we have seen it getting out of control in the past. How should we think about the tail risks?
Yeah, I mean, that's just very difficult because obviously, you know, China going down that route you're talking about would obviously be massive, right? The direct implications, of course, would be it's this huge exporting nation. Yeah. And all of a sudden you would have a lot of even more supply disruption than perhaps you had in the pandemic. And then obviously mm-hmm. there'd be the geopolitical stuff. It's very difficult for markets to kind of price that in advance. But we know the standard things that you would see obviously rally in the dollar, you would yep. see stocks down, you would see bonds up. Now, incidentally, I think, you know what, stocks versus bonds, as in that continued to decline. I think that's something that is going to keep happening anyway in the US. So therefore, anything, you know, that happens down that route where you had more risk due to China, you would continue to see that kind of trend. So I think these are the things that would make the most sense.
Simon, great stuff. Thank you very much indeed for providing us with some context. Up next, we're going to be speaking to Sam Fazeli. He's going to give us the kind of the worst case scenario. What could we be looking at if COVID zero disappears? What does it mean for China? We'll talk about that risk next. Thank you very much indeed, Simon White. This is Bloomberg.
This is The Cable with Guy Johnson and Alex Steele on Bloomberg Radio.
Good evening. You're listening to The Cable, Bloomberg DAB Digital Radio. I'm Alex Steele in New York. Guy Johnson is over in London. So the other option, if President Xi doesn't crack down on protesters, would be to accelerate any kind of reopening. So what are the implications of something like that on a COVID level, on a hospital level, on a death level? Want to bring in Sam Fazeli now. He's director of research at Bloomberg Intelligence. He also is senior U.S. pharmaceutical analyst and has covered COVID since it outbreaked. Outbreaked? That's not a word. Since the outbreak in 2020. Sam, if we just do the what-if game, if we do some kind of reopening in China, what does the case count look like? What does that kind of spread look like?
Yeah, so, Alex, I really don't think there's too many different ways that this can play out. If tomorrow, let's take the simplest possible way, tomorrow they just said absolutely no restrictions, go out and do what you want, there will be a massive wave of infections, virus, a vaccine or not. Of course, it's impossible to go out and vaccinate everybody one more dose right away before you open up, or maybe not impossible, maybe China can do that. Perhaps they could do that and then give everybody a layer of protection against infection, but it's not going to really do much for more than a month or two, as we know, with our own very strong mRNA vaccines. So there will be a massive wave of infections and the inevitable hospitalizations and deaths.
Okay. How even is the healthcare system across China? Are there going to be pockets of significant weakness, pockets of significant strength? If we did see a reopening, how quickly would the weaker areas be overwhelmed?
Yeah, I think you probably know the answer to that. Guy, in that there is such a massive country with regards to healthcare provision that certainly in the cities it's a lot easier than in provinces.
Yep.
And then as soon as you get to a situation where some cities where the provision of intensive care beds is not as good, then you'll have serious trouble. They really need to plan this out. And I'm surprised that they've had all this time and they haven't done it.
What do you think the holdup is then? Like, are they waiting for better vaccines? Like, is it an implementation issue? Like, what do you feel like is a sticking point here?
I really don't know. I think it harks back to the days of not wanting to force people to take vaccines. They seem to be happy to force them to stay at home, but not force them to take vaccines. And that I do not understand, aside from the history of China and vaccines.
If the Chinese authorities turn around to Pfizer, all of these other companies that have been producing these mRNA vaccines and said, can you help? Could they?
They could, but again, it's not going to be something that you can do overnight because let's put aside the manufacturing and getting enough doses. The issue then is, do you have to vaccinate the people, get them to roll up their sleeves, and then wait for that immunity to set in, which would be several weeks. And then again, Guy, we end up in the same situation that we're in. A couple of months later, that wanes, and then you're back to square one in terms of infections. What we need to look at is, have we got enough protection against severe disease? And the answer is the Chinese vaccines appear to do that after three doses. The problem is the percentage of people who are very susceptible, who are triple vaccinated, are low. That's the problem.
So quickly, Sam, would antiviral medication help in this case?
Well, that would be the easiest and quickest way of managing this. Absolutely. They are the drugs that help, and you can manage as soon as you have an infection, take it and really reduce your risk of hospitalization. The problem there is you have to make sure that folks are well trained in making sure that other drugs that it doesn't mix well with are taken care of.
Mr. Sam Fazeli, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
We
always
missed
a pleasure.
You, Sam. It's good to hear your voice.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Yeah, nice to have him back.
Isn't it?
You get Sam back, basically you've got a problem. That seems to
it's
be the narrative here, which is...
Not great.
Not great, but it's always nice to talk to Sam. I hope he's kind of okay with that. I don't want to upset Sam. Anyway, this is Bloomberg.
This is The Cable with Guy Johnson and Alex Steele on Bloomberg Radio.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Cable. We're live on DAB Digital Radio. So, a bit of a false alarm earlier. The UK grid network operator, National Grid, standing down a call to some UK households that they're going to need to cut energy use over the next 24 hours. We are heading into a period of lower wind generation. And this, as we rely so much on that now, is causing a bit of a problem. We've obviously got problems with the availability of gas, but Britain is a huge, huge user of wind power, and we are going to get some gaps. And normally we would fill it with gas generation, but the National Grid is warning that we may see more of these kinds of situations. Joining us now to discuss, Rachel Morrison. Rachel, was this just a sort of early warning of what could come later on in the winter?
Well, this is one of the tools that National Grid has been lining up to help it this winter. And it's been in a test phase up to now. So we had a similar tight period last week, and this demand response tool was in the test phase. And it did get used to sort of check it would work and to check that people would actually respond to this request. But today, they issued a notice this morning saying that they may need to use it tomorrow. Then when they had another look at about 2:30 this afternoon, London time, it seemed like things were going to be okay. That doesn't mean that, you know, there are no problems at all, and it feels like a matter of time before this tool will be used.
So did we learn anything in the last few hours about how the test works and how people responded and all of that?
I think what it shows us is that we have to be prepared for these kind of strange things that we don't normally see in the winter to happen this year.
So does that mean that, like, you guys going to get a notice and, like, guy has to go put on more sweaters or something?
It's only if you had already signed up. So you've been identified by your supplier as having a smart meter, as being somebody that can participate in this. Then they contacted you and said, would you be willing? And even then, if you don't want to do it at the time, you don't have to. So it is a little bit uncertain how well it will work, which is why they wanted to test it. So the idea is that you earn money, you get money off your bill by helping the grid to reduce demand. And in a way, it's how the system should be in the future as we electrify more things, as we're using electric vehicles. We want people to be thinking about their energy use more, to be, you know, using it at times when it's cheaper. So I think it's a sign of things to come, although, albeit during this winter, it's a little bit more alarming than it might be, you know, during the summer.
In terms of the conditions that we need to worry about, my understanding was it was kind of low wind but very cold. We may be getting the low wind, but I'm not sure it's that cold yet.
Yeah, that's right. When we look at the wind model, it's very, very low wind. I mean, below a gigawatt, which is hardly anything until Thursday when it picks up. And it's a bit colder, but, you know, it's not really very cold. So that's why the grid's able to solve these problems quite quickly. So that's why they, you know, looked at the system, saw it was tight, but then thought, actually, it'll be okay. Mm-hmm. So as those temperatures drop, demand increases, then that gap's going to get wider, and that's going to cause more problems. It's going to be more difficult to solve. And that's when they will use this tool.
So if people who signed on don't actually do it and cut their usage when they're asked, what happens? Like, what's the plan C?
Well, the grid does have other contracts with bigger users to cut demand, and this is the first time they're kind of asking households to do it. So in a way, it will show them the incentives aren't big enough for people. They're not being paid enough. They don't care enough. So that will be the job of the energy suppliers and National Grid and Ofgem, the regulator, to go back and say, what can we do to make people care about this? So with the cost of living crisis, it's viewed at the moment that saving money will be the thing that will make people do that. So, you know, if it doesn't work, they'll have to make the savings bigger to entice people to do this, because it's something that needs to happen.
Rachel, can you compare and contrast for me onshore and offshore wind and the ability of either to generate significant amounts of power? How do they stack up right now? There is a big debate in the UK. The Prime Minister is really kind of on the horns of dilemma as to whether to U-turn on onshore wind. But I'm curious as to the kind of the generating capacity that each offers.
Yes, so the UK is really already very committed to offshore wind. We're the second biggest market in the world, just behind China, for offshore wind. So that's already, you know, a big chunk of our renewable supply, and also where there are big plans to grow that capacity. Onshore wind has been much, much smaller and has actually been effectively banned, you know, new projects for years. And as you say, it's still not clear where the Conservatives stand on this, whether they're going to open up offshore wind, you know, mainly where communities want it, because there's a big NIMBY problem with onshore wind and people don't want to see the turbines. They don't, you know, there's a slight misconception that they make a lot of noise. But either way, offshore wind is already such a kind of big market for the UK. It's likely to provide a lot more capacity than onshore wind. You know, it doesn't seem as though there's going to be an enormous boom in onshore wind. However, as we try to decarbonize, we need every bit of renewable generation we can get. So it's definitely something the UK wants. And if we can sort of set it up in a way that the turbines are places where people don't mind, then there's no reason it can't work.
Yeah, people want everything in the way that they want it when they want it, basically. Hey, Rachel, if everybody said, okay, let's put a wind turbine in my backyard tomorrow, could that actually happen? Is the supply and the availability of the turbines there?
These are pretty big things.
Yeah, exactly.
It's interesting. Yeah,
I was being facetious. You're not going to have it in your backyard. But the idea is that if you wanted to put them in there, could you?
I think the supply chain would be somewhat snarled if everybody tried to do it. I mean, the semiconductor supply chain issues that we have, you know, all of those materials are needed to make wind turbines. So there would probably be a long waiting list the way that we see for rooftop solar. And there's, I think you can have one turbine that will serve several houses or maybe a village. So I think we'll see more of those kinds of community projects where people say, we're all up for this. Let's get a wind turbine. And there's one company, Octopus Energy, that's trying to kind of match people that want those turbines with, you know, their ability to build them. But I think it will happen slowly. I don't think it will happen overnight.
I think they look pretty cool, but that's just me.
No,
anyway,
I agree.
I do too.
Yeah. Rachel, thank you very much indeed, as ever, updating us on the important things we all need to worry about. Just got to keep the lights on for tomorrow night. I hear there's another football game that Alex Steele will be paying a great deal of attention to. Bloomberg's Rachel Morrison, thank you very much indeed. Yeah, she's got Fox now. Is it Fox?
Fox
How do you get
Sports.
It?
Fox Sports. Fox but there's Sports. Like a trial thing. It's. I didn't do it. My husband did it. He did some things while I was
he
on
He took
my
notes
shopping.
As well during the game. I'm going to point that one out. This is Bloomberg.
This is The Cable with Guy Johnson and Alex Steele on Bloomberg Radio.
Good evening. You are listening to The Cable, Bloomberg DAB Digital Radio. I'm Alex Steele in New York. Guy Johnson is over in London. Let's get a quick check in here on U.S. markets. The S&P is holding steady right around the lows of the session, down by about 0.9%. NASDAQ's off by 0.7%. Teeny bit of sell-off in the bond market. You still have that flattening between the twos and the tens. That's not going anywhere anytime soon. And the Bloomberg Dollar Index, again, also off the lows as you're looking at crude off the lows as well. But still, you're looking at WTI off by, oh, actually, no, I lie. It flipped around. It just happened. WTI is now up by 1.2%. I just want to point out a couple headlines here coming from Fed officials. James Bullard saying things that you would expect him to say, that he thinks the FOMC is going to need to get to the bottom end of the 5-7% range. He gave a 5-7 range before, but now he says the bottom end of 5-7. He also doesn't think that a recession is inevitable, but he does say that rates are going to have to stay high through next year and into 2024. And then you have Williams saying something very similar, saying that we need to keep restrictive policy through 2023. Maybe we see a normalization then of rates in 2024. He also doesn't see a recession. That's kind of like Goldilocks. Higher rates next year, doesn't really seem like a cut's on the table. Maybe in 2024, but no recession. That would be, I guess, their definition of some kind of soft landing. All right, let's get some other headlines here with Charlie Pellett.
Hi, thank you very much, Alex Steele. Here's what's going on. The Confederation of British Industry says UK retailers are cutting jobs and scaling back investment in response to mounting economic gloom. The business lobby says headcount slumped in the year through November, marking the first decline since August 2021. Investment intentions, meanwhile, fell the most since the early phase of the pandemic 2.5 years ago. Accounting firm KPMG is expanding its Manchester presence with extra tech workers and a revamped office space with meetings at its core. The company says it's going to spend £5.5 million on redesigning the office in Manchester, including the launching of a 25,000 square foot hub next spring for its tech-focused Ignition program, which helps staff collaborate in dozens of cities globally. KPMG is the latest international firm to grow beyond London with with banks such as Goldman Sachs and Citigroup finding it easier to secure lower costs and skilled graduates outside of the UK capital. And BT Group has agreed to give its UK staff a pay raise to help cope with the country's cost of living crisis as part of efforts to settle a dispute with one of Britain's biggest unions and bring the company's first nationwide walkout since 1987 to an end. The former state telecom monopoly says it will increase the salaries of its UK workers, currently earning £50,000 or less, by about £1,500 from January 1st. That is the latest from the news desk. Alex Steele, back to you now here in New York.
All right. Thank you so much, Charlie Pellett. One of the top red stories now is Bullard saying that financial markets are underestimating the chances that policymakers will need to be more aggressive next year. Guy, you know, I wonder, like, how many times can they keep saying we're basically not going to cut next year in the market, yet still doesn't believe them?
Wait until Powell on Wednesday. I think that's what I'm going to kind of listen to see exactly what he has to say. Is he more hawkish than the minutes? Is he going to reinforce this idea that, yes, we may be heading for a lower trajectory, a sort of lower trajectory in terms of the way rate hikes are going to work, but ultimately the destination is high or higher, and those rates are going to stay there for a while.
Exactly. Stay there for a while. All right, let's switch gears here and talk about international relations. President Macron is headed to Washington, D.C. this week. No doubt, front and center will be the Inflation Reduction Act, which basically gives a lot of subsidies to different companies that wind up producing chips in Mexico, the U.S., or Canada, or cars in Mexico, U.S., or Canada. And you know what? Europe's not that happy about it. They have their own CHIPS Act, but it might not be enough to compete with the IRA. So let's get more insight here with Alan Katz. He's Bloomberg Paris bureau chief. He joins us now. Alan, what is Macron hoping to get out of this trip to D.C.?
Well, that's a good question. The first thing he wants to get out of it is some diplomatic credit. So this is, he's the first French president in decades to have been invited to two state dinners, and he's made a big deal about that and how honored he is for that. And this is Biden's first state dinner, and it's going to France, and isn't that wonderful? So he's trying to make some hay out of that sort of diplomatic coup that he pulled on that front. But more to the point, it comes back to your comment about the Inflation Reduction Act, and France has been one of the leading countries in Europe really complaining about that and complaining about the amount of subsidy that companies that particularly want to produce, as you said, cars and chips and other industrial goods in the U.S. will get from it. And the U.S. isn't going to change its laws. It's, as you know, it's very difficult to change laws in the United States. They can, you know, tinker at the margins in terms of implementation, but mostly what Macron wants is ammunition to come back to Europe and say we really need to have a European Inflation Reduction Act, a European Green Subsidy Act, much bigger and much more, with a lot more money behind it than we've ever done before. That's really looks like the goal.
Is he going to get it? And will the Germans be convinced, Alan?
that's the $1 million question, guy.
He laughs at you. I think that says it all.
Look, this has been, I mean, the French have been pushing for this for, you know, several administrations, and the Germans have always opposed it. The EU as an organization has always opposed it. But we live in a different world today than we used to, right? People are aware of China's, you know, insistent, competition rather than cooperation with the West. People have noticed, you know, parts shortages for whether it's batteries or chips for cars. It is a different world now. Will he get it? Will he convince the Germans? That it really is unclear. But certainly the French have more ammunition now in terms of the balance of power within Europe to try to convince the Germans than they have had in the past. And I think that if Biden sort of comes out and says publicly, yes, actually the U.S. would be fine if Europe did the equivalent kind of green subsidy program, that really would give Macron a big boost in trying to convince the Germans at least to do it. Whether that really happens, whether they put the money behind it, that's another question.
Well, that was my next question. What kind of money or program or subsidy would be sufficient enough to not start a trade war with the U.S., but also give enough juice for European companies?
You get different answers to that question from different economists. It's about the French Prime Minister, Elizabeth Borne, said that the Inflation Reduction Act was going to cost France about 10,000 jobs and 10 billion euros of investment. Some economists that we've spoken to have said that, you know, the overall number for Europe would have to be somewhere similar to the U.S. in the neighborhood of 500 billion euros or dollars. That's a lot of money. You know, is Europe really going to get behind that? It's very hard to say in advance. I wouldn't go out on a limb and give a prediction one way or the other on that one.
Just to come back to the issue of the Germans, Christian Lindner, the finance minister, thinks that government should not be involved. That in some ways is anathema to the French approach to industrial planning. If he were to get the green light, how would you go about producing such a policy that would satisfy everybody?
Slowly, confusingly, and messily.
Oh, good. That was going to be easy.
No, but that's the way that European policy always works, yeah. Right? One, the German politics, just the German coalition itself, is a disparate group of people who have quite different views on whether you should have industrial policy or not, and forget about the climate policy and other differences within the German coalition. Within Europe, you have quite large differences between various countries and how they view industrial policy, with France probably being the most statist, the most dirigist, and, you know, maybe the Netherlands being the least, the most free market in general. But, you know, oftentimes, though, Europe, you know, it's one of those things. It never works, and then they come to some sort of compromise. Will this happen that way? It's quite possible.
Alan, great stuff, as ever. Looking forward to the coverage. Alan Katz joining us out of Paris. This is Bloomberg.
This is The Cable with Guy Johnson and Alex Steele on Bloomberg Radio.
How is German industry going to cope with the upsets that we're seeing in China at the moment, the protests we're seeing in China at the moment? We caught up a little bit earlier on, alongside Bloomberg's Ed Ludlow, with one of the biggest companies out of Germany, the tech giant, the chip giant, Infineon. We caught up with the company's CFO, Sven Schneider.
Why is it so difficult still to get hold of these basic chips that go into vehicles?
I think there are two components. The one is this super huge and strong structural demand. It's not so much about the numbers of cars being produced, but it's the content per car, which is going up significantly if you look at electrification of cars or if you look at automation of cars. So that's the underlying demand. On the supply side, there was a structural underinvestment for quite some time, including the foundries in Asia, in the mature nodes. And indeed, this is one of the reasons why this planned investment into our Dresden fab, where we are planning to spend, subject to adequate funding, up to 5 billion euros, this is 130 nanometers power and analog mixed signal, exactly that sweet spot where we see a very strong supply for the years to come, but not a lot of demand. Sorry, the other way around. We see a lot of demand, but there's not enough supply from the production side. So that's why this makes a lot of sense from our perspective, and I would probably agree with your statement on the auto side.
Let's talk a little bit about that Dresden plant. Subject to adequate support, you've just talked about, effectively, the European Chips Act. How much are you relying on government support? How much are you relying on that European Chips Act, which is effectively designed to compete with the US Chips Act for that Dresden plant? And how confident are you that you are going to get that funding?
Yes, Guy, we are getting a lot of support from the national government, but also from the EU, given that it has been clearly stated by both that the resilience and the advantage of bringing manufacturing of chips into Europe is one of the key topics they want to really address in the next year. So there's a lot of positive support. We are expecting that to come through in the next months. I cannot comment on any number. It is premature. We are in the middle of the negotiations. But I think it's, as you say, it is important for Europe, as it is important for the US, as it is important for Japan, to have this national CHIPS Act in order to support and to contribute positively to the geopolitical challenges we are seeing. And it's, by the way, not only the manufacturing and the funding, it's the whole ecosystem.
Yes.
It's the R&D, it's the cooperation with research, it's getting talented employees and workforce. So it's a lot more than just the production and the funding.
Sven, hi, it's Alex in New York. Nevertheless, Europe's really mad about the Inflation Reduction Act. President Macron is going to be going over to D.C. to talk about this. There's been meetings with business leaders about it. Can whatever Germany does or whatever governments do in Europe compete with the subsidies that the IRA is offering?
Let's see. I think we are making good progress here, and you also should understand that the EU has to do that in a way that really all the member states are supportive and are happy with the outcome. But I think at the end of the day, it is, as I said, important that we reduce this very high resilience from a small part of the world. And if it is in the US, if it is in Japan, if it is in Europe, I think at the end of the day, for a global company like ourselves, it doesn't matter too much. I think it's just something we all need to do jointly. And then let's see at the end of the day which instrument, which government successfully chooses. But I think all in all, they are all aligned on the purpose behind it.
That was Sven Schneider, Infineon Technologies CFO. In my mind, that was very much CFO speak for show me the money. Like, sure, let's see. Put your money where your mouth is and show me where you're going to put the cash, and then we'll see where we're going to put our investments. But nonetheless, it's a huge problem. How do you stay friendly and then also wind up helping your country? And on a micro level, it's also difficult for countries within Europe who's also going to be struggling with the same kind of issues. Okay, anyway, coming up, let's go to the market here. We're getting more headlines from BlockFi filing for bankruptcy. Risk-off mood continues.
This is The Cable with Guy Johnson and Alex Steele on Bloomberg Radio.
Good evening. You're listening to The Cable on Bloomberg DAB Digital Radio. I'm Alex Steele in New York. Guy Johnson's over in London. Let's talk about markets here because we have the China news overnight. Definitely then you have volatility. I struggle to say volatility because the VIX is still under 22. But you have a decline in equity prices. You have energy continues to roll over. You have BlockFi actually imploding yet again, declaring Chapter 11 bankruptcy. Equities hit the lows of the session after that. Crude, actually, I should point out, did get a bid. You're getting continued hawkish conversation from Fed officials, from Bullard to Williams. No hike. No cut for next year at all. We're looking at hikes, 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 making that very clear. Markets kind of take it in stride. Let's get some more details here. Kriti Gupta joins us for more. I'm really struggling to make sense of the reaction function of the markets. You know, we get pretty significantly hawkish heads from the Fed, and like markets do nothing.
Yeah, I think there seems to be, I mean, I hate to say this, I feel like I'm on repeat here, but it feels just like there's some sort of complacency built into the market because you aren't actually seeing that even when there are even positive headlines, you aren't actually seeing the stock market specifically react with any sort of enthusiasm. Mm-hmm. I think you're seeing a lot more volatility and a lot more kind of call to action in the commodity market and arguably the currency market as well. But the bond markets and the stock markets just are tied to this narrative that we're going to keep selling off into the end of the year and the Fed isn't going to pivot anytime soon. And any kind of reaction that you do see in the intermediate will ultimately turn around. And I don't particularly see a fundamental narrative to support that. But, you know, when you talk to some of these fund managers or when you talk to some of these traders and they're kind of like, I don't know. I don't know if I want to hop in yet or I don't know if I want to sell more yet. So there is just kind of this, like I said, complacency, for lack of a better term.
Is that because a lot of managers are done for the year, do you think?
It might be. And there might be kind of like a pension liability twist to it. There might be some tax reasons involved as well. But
love tax loss harvesting.
There you go.
Yeah, it is.
Very exciting.
But
yeah.
There's the highlight of the year, apparently. What's interesting, though, is look, this is very different from the winter ahead of the holiday season you've seen in the past couple of years. And I think there is a real sentiment here that the inflation drawdown that a lot of markets or a lot of market participants have really kind of pinned their hopes to is just not happening fast enough. And until they see the deceleration that is more than just one data point, sound like someone I work for the Federal Reserve now, but like until it's more than one data point and until they see it going down way faster than before, which will happen, by the way, as you start to take base effects into account, until then, no dice.
Well, I also am looking at equity market volume, terrible.
Yeah.
It has been for the last week and a half. Mm-hmm. I also have gotten multiple 2023 report outlooks before Thanksgiving. Normally, you get them mid-December. And I feel like this is all part and parcel of that end of year. We're kind of done and moving away, which in my mind also makes sense of why we're seeing the winners sell off, right? Energy got hit hard the last week and a half. Sure, energy was one of the biggest winners of the year. I mean, I feel like is it just that potentially simple over the next 4 weeks?
I don't think it's simple, but you know, I have to say I was equally surprised that you see some of these year end forecasts coming out so early, because there are still some game changers in the mix here. Game changers that aren't being priced in by the market, like these protests that have erupted over the weekend, by the way. But also game changers like even in the United States government. I just ran into Jeannie Zeno, one of our Bloomberg TV contributors for Balance of Power, and a true expert on the field. She said, look, this kind of budget agreement, it was supposed to happen December 16th. It's now getting pushed back to December 23rd. And that could be a game changer. A potential rail strike December 9th could be a game changer, not to mention all the eco data that you're going to get in the meantime.
Well, that's the other thing. We've got a really busy week coming up, and I wonder if people are just sitting back and going, I'm going to wait and see how this one plays out. You've got Powell on Wednesday. You've got European CPI coming out this week. You've got PCE out of the United States. You've got, I think, ISM manufacturing, JOLTS, payrolls on Friday. You've got a French presidential trip to DC on Thursday. There's a lot going on this week.
There's a lot going on this week, and I think one of the issues with trading off eco data that we've seen in the past couple of months has just been the idea that we're seeing diverging signals. So you could have, for example, consumer sentiment data coming at super, super decade low levels, yet consumer spending is still rocking and rolling. There are divergences in what would traditionally be kind of historic correlations or historic trends that would make sense. Things like if you get a positive JOLTS number, that means that I guess things are bad at the moment, I guess, if we're pricing in that as bad news. But there are divergences right now in the eco data that doesn't actually give you a clear picture. And I think for that reason, it isn't actually eco data that's driving the market. It's these bigger inflection points like the U.S. budget, like these Chinese protests, like what happens with the ECB.
Well, and this begs the point. So Guy's been like, I'm all about Powell, right? Later on this week, on Wednesday.
Yeah.
Is Powell going to be able to say anything different that will move the markets? I mean, I feel like every Fed official is very clear.
Yeah.
Rates are going to go higher next year. They're going to stay higher for longer. We're not cutting next year.
Yeah. Well, look at what happened with the FOMC minutes last week, right? We had a pretty dramatic reaction to essentially what you just said. The message hasn't really changed, and yet the markets were looking for some sort of kernel of evidence that somehow there was going to be a dovish pivot afloat, and they reacted accordingly, only to pare back the gains the very next day. So I think when you take into account what Chairman Powell is saying, like, yes, it's going to be a game changer, and yes, there may be some intermediate trading there, I don't think in the long term it's going to change the trajectory of the markets. I think what will change it, by the way, though, is December 14th, because a lot of people, December 14th, by the way, is the next FOMC decision.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Mm-hmm. That is going to be a crucial day, not just because it's a Fed day, but also because a lot of the expectation going on from earlier this year was that by the time we end 2022, there will be a very clear step down at some point, that 2023 will not be a year of 75 basis point hikes. We have yet to see that actually get priced into the market, and we have yet to see that actually come to fruition. And the jury's still out. And I think that's a really important game changer that will actually create a consensus trade that could then help bolster the markets.
I guess that's one reason why people probably haven't checked out completely.
Right.
They are waiting for that meeting. As you say, it could provide a useful narrative into next year. Kriti, thank you very much indeed. Bloomberg's Kriti Gupta on what's happening in these markets. We are just about done for the day, Alex. That is it. The busy week continues, though. Plenty more to digest. In fact, it's a really packed week this week. But the good news is we're done with the shopping now. We can move on.
Are we? Are we, though? I don't... What's that statement?
You said you've done all the shopping. You said you've done all the shopping.
Yeah, but there's still deals to be... Like, maybe I will buy those shoes that I really wanted if the deal is good enough, as I may or may not be checking online. He just doesn't get me, you guys. We'll see you tomorrow. This is Bloomberg.